Perhaps you'd let me have a go at your eyebrows. So, Engel stormed back to the car and stalled at getting into gear. She was that angry. Started it up again right away, though, pulled away smoothly. Didn't even look at Paul as she drove off, left him to close the gate himself. Don't think any of them noticed me. They were far too busy watching the Paul and Engel romantic comedy. I got a look at the Gestapo captain, too. I know I was supposed to keep my head down, but I couldn't stop myself gaping a little. That is the man who interrogated Julie. The man who will order her execution, or who already has. I don't know what I expected, but he just looked like anybody. Like the sort of chap who would come into the shop and buy a motorbike for his lad's 16th birthday. Like your headmaster. But also, he looked like he was on his knees. Dog-tired, absolutely haggard with it. He looked like he hadn't slept for a week. The pilots all looked like that in September of 1940, during the worst days of the Battle of Britain. The vicar's lad looked like that, running out to his plane the day he was killed. I didn't know then, I mean, I didn't know earlier today, when I saw the captain's face and thought how tired and worried he seemed. But I know now that the Omega Gestapo is an uproar, not only because of the captain having made the mistake about allowing Penn's interview, but also because they have been burgled. Mitraillette dragged this out of slave girl Engel during the ritual cognac at the Thibaut's. A set of keys went missing for an hour early last week, then turned up again in the wrong place, and nobody can account for the time they were gone. Every single one of the staff has been grilled by the captain, and tomorrow the captain himself goes to be grilled by his commander, the dreadful Nicholas Ferber. If I were the captain, I would clamp a muzzle on Engel. Fairly certain she's not supposed to leak information like that. Well, if she won't come to us willingly, perhaps we can blackmail her. Now's our chance. And it's down to me to pull her in. Can't believe I told that intelligence officer I couldn't do this kind of work. Couldn't be more anxious than I am anyway. So relieved to be doing anything useful. Don't think I'll sleep much tonight, though. I keep thinking about what Theo said after my first Lysander ferry flight. We might as well be operational. Fly the plane, Maddie. Horrid dream about guillotines. All in French. Very bad French, probably. Never imagined I could dream in French. I was using Etienne's pocket knife to tighten up screws attaching a cable that lifted the blade to make sure it would fall cleanly. Sickening. If it was a messy death, it would all be my fault. I kept thinking, it works just like a choke. C'est comme un starter. Aye right, miss, as Jock would say. If I don't end up in that foul hotel courtyard with my head in a tin wash tub, it will be a blooming miracle. I sat in Amélie's favourite café for an hour waiting for an old man whose name I didn't know to tell me, L'ange descend en 10 minutes. 10 minutes till the angel comes down. That meant Engel had gone to get the car out of the garage so she can take the Gestapo captain to meet his dreadful CO. Then, all I had to do was walk past the front of the hotel just as she was ushering him into the car and hand her a lipstick with a slip of paper hidden in the sleeve which tells her where we have arranged her own personal cachette. If she wants to make contact with the resistance, she can leave a note in the kids' cafe, folded in a linen handkerchief which is wedged beneath a table leg to stop it rocking. Of course, she can also set a trap for me now, since I will have to collect the note and she knows it. You know what? If she's going to rat on me, she doesn't need to set a trap. If she's going to rat on me, I'm already dead. When I caught up with her this afternoon, I knelt quickly at her feet, as though she'd lost something. When really it was me planting it there, then I stood up and held out the shiny little tube. I smiled like an idiot and spoke half a dozen of the 2 dozen words I know in German. Verzeihung, aber Sie haben Ihren Lippenstift fallen gelassen. Excuse me, you dropped your lipstick. The captain was already inside the car and Engel hadn't opened her own door yet. He couldn't hear us. I wouldn't be able to understand anything she answered, so I was supposed to smile sweetly, and if she didn't take the lipstick, I was supposed to say,
Es tut mir leid, dass es doch nicht ihr Lippenstift war.
I'm sorry, it wasn't your lipstick after all. She looked down at the gold tube, frowning, then looked up at my bland, gormless grin. She asked curiously, and in English,
Are you Maddie Brodat?
It's a good thing I was already smiling. I just sort of let the smile sit frozen on my face. Felt utterly false, as though I had on a mask, like I was wearing someone else's face. But I didn't stop smiling. I shook my head.
Kette habicht, I said.
She nodded once, like a bow. She took the lipstick and opened the driver's door of the Mercedes and climbed in.
Danke, Kette,
she said before she shut the door. Thanks, Kette. Dead casual. Informal and cheeky, as though I were a little girl. As she drove away, I remembered that Kette isn't supposed to understand English.
Fly the plane. I wish I could. I wish I had control. I'm not dead yet, and we've got Engel's answer. I collected it myself, getting quite confident about cycling into town, as Mitraillette always uses the same checkpoint. They know me now, and wave me through without bothering to check my papers. Engel's left us Julie's scarf. I didn't recognize it at first. It was lying under the table in the cafe, and the lad who sweeps the floors handed it to me.
C'est à vous?
Is this yours? I didn't know what it was at first, a wad of dull grey cloth. But when I touched it, I realized it was silk, so I took it in case it was important. I knotted it around my neck, smiling my idiot smile.
Merci.
Thanks.
I sat there for 10 more minutes, my stomach turning over with fear and excitement, forcing myself to finish a bowl of the most horrid, phony coffee ever brewed, so I wouldn't look suspicious leaving in a hurry. Bicycled home like a demon, pulled the crumpled silk from round my neck and spread it flat on my bed in Etienne's room. That's when I realized it was Julie's Parisian silk scarf. I was only little when Dad died, but I remember how I used to open the drawer where he kept his ties before Gran cleared them out and take a big sniff. And the ties all smelled like Dad, still, like cherry tobacco and cologne and a whiff of motor oil. I loved the smell of those ties. It brought him back. Julie's scarf doesn't smell like Julie anymore. I did stick my nose in it. It smells like carbolic soap. Like a school, or a prison, I suppose. There's ink smeared all over one corner and the silk's all perished down the middle as though she and Engel have been playing tug-of-war with it. That chemical smell, sweet and tarry, not like Julie at all. It reminded me that Penn told us Engel is a chemist. I ran downstairs.
Tu cherches Gabrielle Therese?
You want my sister? Asked La Cadette, glancing up from her schoolbooks at the kitchen table.
Oui, tout de suite. Right now. I need an iron, a hot iron. Oh, bother. Frustration. I had no idea how to say it. Mimed ironing.
That kid is so sharp. Got it right away. Tossed Maman's irons into the kitchen fire to hot up, pointed me to the ironing board, and ran for her sister.
Mitraillette and Amelie and I stood like the witches in Macbeth over the ironing board, holding our breath.
I was so worried I'd ruin it, burn the scarf, but I didn't. And after a minute or so, Engel's message began to appear in scratchy brown print among the grey paisley in the corner opposite the inkstain. You don't need to be trained by the special operations executive to know how to use invisible ink. You don't even need to be a chemist. Me and Beryl learned how to do it in Girl Guides. We used to write secret messages in milk. It's easy.
I don't know what Engel used, but she wrote in French, so I don't remember her exact words. She's either tipped us off or betrayed us. Won't know which till later tonight. Mitraillette has sent for Paul. They use his courier as the go-between. We don't actually know where he stays. This evening, there are 19 prisoners from Poitiers being transported to a concentration camp somewhere in the northeast of France. The bus will swing by Orme and pick up 5 more prisoners here.
Julie will be with them.
If I make it like an accident report...
Don't think I can possibly make it sound like an accident report, but I've got to write something. Have to remember, there may be a trial. I don't bloody care if there is. I want to get it right while I remember. Mitraillette tried to dose me with knockout drops again a few minutes ago. 30 minutes to oblivion. But this time I'm wise to her and I want to write. Perhaps I'll take it after. I think I will. When I'm finished, I won't want to think anymore.
Incident report. Attempted sabotage of Poitou River Bridge on the Tour to Poitiers Road, with intention of stopping German military bus carrying 24 French and Allied prisoners. Wednesday, the 1st of December, 1943.
Well, we did stop them. Made a great big hole in the bridge, too, that'll keep them deporting anybody via the railway station at Tours for a while. I hate them. I hate them.
Must remember Paul.
Paul, who I also hated. He was marvellous, I have to say it. He planned it all on the fly, made it up as we went along. Carnage wasn't his fault. Mustered an army of a dozen men and two women in about an hour. We left all the bikes and the car hidden. It is the same Citroën Rosalie. I don't know how the man who owns it avoids being found out or at least having his car impounded, and I think he is too old for this kind of job anyway. We hid the car in a garage, believe it or not, belonging to a lovely and heroic old woman who lives by herself in a riverside villa on the Tour side of the Poitou. She is the rose grower the circuit is named for. We left our car parked behind her car, which is conveniently a newer and bigger model Rosalie, so it looked like ours had been her previous car, and we hid it under a dust sheet as well. The bikes were hidden in her abandoned stables beneath 20-year-old hay. Then we borrowed her boats, one beautiful teak 19th-century rowing boat and two chestnut Canadian canoes, much too good for us. The bridge is upstream from the house. They disrupted traffic here before, some time ago, and for a while the lady was under strict surveillance. Hope she won't be in too much trouble again now, though she seems to have got away with it this time. We were careful. Godless as I am, I pray she's got away with it. It's like ripples in a pond, isn't it? Doesn't stop in one place. Anyway, we loaded up our fireworks in the boats. Don't think I can give details on the explosives, as I wasn't responsible and didn't pay attention, and we rowed up to the bridge in the dark. Took about an hour with muffled oars. You read about muffled oars in pirate stories. I'm sure there's a bit in Peter Pan where they use muffled oars. Perhaps it was swallows and Amazons. English summer and the school holidays seem dead far away now. It was hard to see. The river was full of fog, but we made it. We wired up the bridge and waited.
What went wrong?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It wasn't a trap. We weren't outnumbered, not at first. I suppose we were just playing for higher stakes than the Germans. Shouldn't we have guessed they'd be more ruthless than us? How could we guess? We were pretty ruthless.
What went wrong?
Perhaps it was just too dark, night and fog both. The fog was good as well as bad because it hid us, but it was just so hard to see. There should have been a quarter moon, for what that's worth, but the sky was overcast and we were blind until the prison bus turned up with its headlights blazing. That bit went well. Within a minute we had thoroughly disabled it. We were pretty well camouflaged in the riverbank scrub, a tangle of willow and alder and poplar full of mistletoe. Lots of tall, withering weeds hiding us, and the fog, too. Our small explosion hurt no one except the bridge and the bus. The radiator grill got blown out, but the blast missed the headlights and the battery must have been okay, because there was enough light that Paul and the owner of the Rosalie somehow managed to put bullets through three of the tyres. The driver got out. Then a guard got out. They had electric torches. Both men walked up and down the length of the bus, inspecting the damage and cursing. Paul picked them off like ducks at a funfair with his Sten submachine gun. While that was going on, I was curled uselessly in a ball with my arms over my head and my teeth clenched, so I missed a bit of the action. Born to be a soldier, my foot. A raid is actually quite a lot like a battle. It is war. It's war in miniature, but it's still war. Two other guards came out of the bus and fired random shots into the bushes at us in the dark. Mitraillette had to sit on me to stop me blowing our cover. I was in such a flap. Finally, Paul gave me a clout over the head.
Get a grip on yourself, Kitty Hawk, he hissed. We need you. You're a crack shot, but no one's expecting you to kill anybody. Focus on tools, all right? They'll start trying to fix things in a moment. Try to disable their equipment.
I gulped and nodded. Don't know if he saw me nodding, but he shifted back to his own position beneath the gently rustling willow herb and hemlock alongside the Rosalie driver, and they bagged another guard. The surviving guard leapt back into the bus. There was an ominous silence. Not a thing happened for a minute or two. Then the four remaining soldiers ushered every single one of the prisoners out of the bus and made them lie down, side by side, on their faces in the middle of the road. It was all done by the glancing light of electric torches, and we didn't dare fire at anyone now for fear of hitting one of ours. Couldn't see any individual faces. Couldn't tell anything about the captives, not their age or their sex or how they were dressed. But you could tell by the way they moved that some of them were scared, and some of them were defiant, and some were chained together by their feet. The chained ones had a hard time getting down to the road, tripping each other up as they climbed off the bus. When everybody was lined up on their faces in the mud like sardines, one of the guards shot six of them in the head. It happened so fast. This dreadful man shouted at us in French. Mitraillette whispered all the English words she could come up with in my ear. Revenge! Two for one! Their own dead! If we kill...
I know, I whispered back, she say.
For every one of them we murdered, they would murder two of us, disposable hostages. Three guards kept their guns trained on the prisoners while the fourth set off on foot back down the road, to find a telephone, I think. Then we waited. Stalemate. It was bitterly cold. Paul and a couple of other men had a quick whispered council and decided to work their way beneath the bridge and try to attack the guards from behind. There really were only three guards left, plus the one who had gone for help. It seemed impossible we shouldn't be able to get the better of them. But they had 18 hostages lying helpless and chained at their feet. And one of their hostages was Julie. Or perhaps, I worried then, perhaps she'd already been shot. Impossible to tell at first, but then the guards set up a portable floodlight attached to the bus's battery and got the prisoners spotlit so you could see now that only a few of them were women and that everybody looked half-starved. And among them, right in the middle of them, was the one I was looking for. A mound of blonde hair and a flame-coloured pullover. Her arms were bound tightly behind her back with wire, it looked like, so she was really lying flat on her face more than the others who were resting on their forearms. But she wasn't at the end of the row. She wasn't one of the six that had just been killed. She was breathing quietly, waiting, shaking with cold like the rest of us. And we waited, I think, for an hour. The guards made sure they were hard to aim at. They kept moving and flashing their electric torches into our faces, or where they thought our faces were, occasionally blinding us. I discovered later that I'd bitten my thumbnails down to their bleeding nail beds waiting for Paul's planned assault from behind. It never came. The three German soldiers organized themselves so that they were always facing in different directions, and one of them always kept a gun trained on the prisoners. We just couldn't get to them. One of the women lying in the road began to weep. I think it was just because she was so cold. And when the man next to her tried to put his arm round her, the guard shot him in the hand. That was when I realized we weren't going to win this battle, that we could not win. I think Mitraillette knew it then, too. She squeezed my shoulder lightly. She was also weeping, but silently. The fourth guard came back and began to chat casually with his mates. We waited. It was not quiet anymore because, as well as the soldiers talking and the woman crying, the man with the hurt hand was groaning and gasping. But there wasn't much other noise, only the little noises of night on a riverbank. Wind in the bare branches, the hollow rush of water beneath the damaged stone bridge. Then Julie lifted her head and said something to the soldiers that made them laugh. I swear we couldn't hear her, but I swear she was chatting them up. Or something like it. One of them came over and prodded her here and there with the end of his rifle, as though he were testing a piece of meat. Then he squatted down by her head and took her chin in his hand. He asked her a question. She bit him. He pushed her face down into the road hard and scrambled to his feet. But as he lowered his rifle at her, one of the other guards laughed and stopped him.
"He says not to kill her," Mitraillette whispered. "If they kill her, there will be no fun." "Is she crazy?" I hissed. "What the blazes did you bite him for? She'll get herself shot." "Exactement," Mitraillette agreed. "C'est rapide, fast. No Nazi fun."
Then the reinforcements arrived. Two military lorries with canvas sides with half a dozen armed guards in each. Even then, we still weren't badly outnumbered. They began to unload sandbags and planks and managed to lever the bus up out of the hole it had landed in, reversed it, and laid planks over the damage so they could try to get the lorries across. But then when they were ready to load the lorries, they got resistance. Not just from us. A few of their captives came to life. A handful of the men who weren't chained just ran for it, dived into the ditch at the opposite side of the road, and lucky for them, it turned out, ran straight into Paul and his men, who hustled them under the bridge and back to the boats by the river path. More shooting as a couple of soldiers went after them, and Paul's men pounded the soldiers. "Go for the equipment," Paul had ordered. And for a minute, the gunfire was so fierce, I knew two shots from my small revolver would go unnoticed. I aimed at the chains. The double tap, two quick shots at the same target. The chains I was aiming at burst apart like a toy balloon. Could hardly believe my luck. And the two men I'd managed to free also ran. When another man tried to run, the soldiers mowed him down like bank robbers in an American gangster film. When the first man had fled, the guard Julie had attacked held her down with his heel dug into the back of her neck. He wasn't giving her a chance. She fought hard and got kicked for it by the one who had said not to kill her. So now, with a few of the hostages dead and a few loaded up in the lorries and a few escaped, there were only seven living people left lying on the ground. Julie, with the guard's boot against the back of her neck, and two other women, two of the remaining men were chained ankle to ankle. And now the German corporal, or whatever he was, the fellow in charge who had arrived with the reinforcements, decided to teach everyone a thorough lesson. Us for trying to free their prisoners, and the prisoners for wanting to be freed. He picked on the men, mainly the two who weren't chained, and hauled them to their feet. And seeing that Julie was getting special treatment from the man who was holding her in place with his foot, he hauled her to her feet as well, pushed her over to stand next to the two other standing prisoners. One of them a sturdy workman, and one a handsome lad my own age, both ragged and battered. Julie was ragged too. She was still wearing exactly the clothes she'd had on when she parachuted into France. Grey wool flannel skirt and Parisian chic pullover, the burnt scarlet orange of Chinese lanterns, with holes in the elbows now. Her hair shone brassy gold in the artificial light, falling loose and wild down her back. Her face was skin over bone, as though she'd aged 50 years in 8 weeks, gaunt, grey, frail. The dead spit of Jamie when I first met him in hospital, but thinner. She looked like a kid, a head shorter than the shortest of the men standing around her. Any of those soldiers could have picked her up and tossed her in the air. Three prisoners in a line. The soldier in command gave an order, and the guard who'd been holding Julie down took aim at the younger of the captive men, and with one bullet maimed him low between his legs. The lad shrieked and collapsed, and they fired at him again, first blowing apart one elbow and then the other. And then they hauled him to his feet again, still shrieking, and made him walk to the lorry and climb in. And then they turned to the next man and fired on him low in the groin also. Mitraet and I both knelt wheezing with horror, side by side under cover of the undergrowth and darkness. Julie stood cowering, white as paper in the harsh glare of the floodlight, staring straight ahead of her at nothing. She was next. She knew it. We all knew it. But they weren't finished with their second victim yet. When they shot him in one elbow, and then again rapidly in the same place to shatter it, my not very reliable control just went, and I burst into tears. I couldn't help it. Something snapped. Like when we went to help the gunner at Maid's End and found the dead boys, I burst into loud, gulping sobs, bawling like a baby. Her face. Julie's face. Her face suddenly lit up like a sunrise. Joy and relief and hope all there at once. And she was instantly lovely again. Herself. Beautiful. She heard me. Recognized my fear of gunfire blubbing. She didn't dare call out to me, didn't dare give me away, or May's most desperate fugitive. They fired at the second man again, destroying his other arm, and he fainted dead away. They had to drag him to the lorry. Julie was next. Suddenly, she laughed wildly and gave a shaking yell, her voice high and desperate. "Kiss me, Hardy! Kiss me! Quick!" Turned her face away from me to make it easier. And I shot her. I saw her body's flinch. The blows knocked her head aside as though she'd been thumped in the face. Then she was gone. Gone. One moment flying in green sunlight, then the sky suddenly grey and dark. Out like a candle. Here. Then gone. I'll just keep writing, shall I? Because that wasn't the end. It wasn't even a pause. The officer pulled another woman up from the ground to take Julie's place. This doomed girl screamed at us in French. "Allez, allez, go, go! Résistance idiot sale, vous nous massacrez tous!" Filthy resistance idiots, you're killing us all! I knew what she was saying even with my rubbish schoolgirl French. And she was right. We ran. They fired at our backs and came after us. Paul and his men fired at their backs, swarming over the bridge walls, and they turned to face this rear attack. Carnage. Carnage. Half of us, Paul with them, were torn to bits on the bridge. The rest of us made it back to the boats and set off down the river with the five fugitives we'd managed to save. When we were away from the bank and someone else was rowing and there was nothing more for me to do, I bent over with my head on my knees, my heart in pieces. It is still in pieces. I think it will be in pieces forever. Mitraet gently unlocked my fingers from the Colt 32 and made me put it away. She whispered, "C'était la vérité?" Was that verity? Or perhaps she just meant, was that the truth? Was it true? Did any of it really happen? Were the last 3 hours real? "Yes," I whispered back. "Oui. C'était la vérité." Don't know how I kept going. You just do. You have to, so you do. The original idea, when we hoped we'd have 24 extra people to move and hide, was to ferry them to the opposite bank, where we'd divide them into smaller groups of 2 or 3. Then we were going to split up our own team to guide them cross-country towards various sheds and cow buyers for the night, before the more complicated task of smuggling them safely out of France, across the Pyrenees or the English Channel. But now we only had 5 fugitives to hide, and there were only 7 of us left, so there was room for everybody to make a single trip back to the riverside villa. Mitraillette made the decision to keep us together. Don't think I'd ever noticed, so absorbed in my own fears and worries. But she was Paul's second in command. Not sure we'd have pulled it off without her either. We were just all so dazed, but she drove us like a demon. Vite, vite, quickly! Orders whispered sharp and quiet. Boats hauled back onto the racks, oars put away, all of it carefully dried off with dust sheets which we hid beneath the floorboards afterwards. You can work in a daze. If someone gives you a mindless job, you can do it automatically even if your heart is in pieces. Mitraillette thought of everything. Perhaps she's done it before. We brushed the oars and hulls lightly with handfuls of ancient straw from the stables, leaving a fine layer of dust over everything. The 5 men from the prison bus worked silently and willingly alongside us, anxious to help. The boathouse was perfect when we left, looked like it hadn't been used in years. Then the Nazi search party arrived, and we spent an hour lying in the mud along the riverbank, hiding in the bulrushes like Moses, waiting for them to leave. Could hear them chatting with the groundskeeper. He came back later to lock up the boathouse and give us the all clear, such as it was. Now there were Nazi guards posted on the front drive, so we'd not be getting the Rosalie out any time soon. But the groundskeeper thought it would be safe for a couple of bicycles to leave by the river path on the opposite bank. Benzedrine handed out all round. Got one of the canoes out again and ferried 2 of the bikes, 2 of us and 2 of the escaped prisoners over the river, and saw them off into the fog. At this point, one of the remaining lads from the bus collapsed in a shivering heap, and Mitraillette sort of stalled. Nous sommes faits, she said. We've had it. We bedded down in the stables with the bicycles. Not the safest place in the world. I wonder where that is right now, the safest place in the world. Even the neutral countries, Sweden and Switzerland, are surrounded. Ireland's stuck with being divided. They have to mark the neutral bit Ireland in big letters made of whitewashed stones, hoping the Germans won't drop bombs there, thinking it's the UK side of the northern border. I've seen it from the air. South America, perhaps? We were all still wide awake when it grew light. I was sitting with my arms wrapped around my knees, side by side with one of the lads who'd escaped when I shot his chains apart. The men who'd been chained had to stay with us because they'd got to get rid of the fetters on their ankles before they could go anywhere. How did they catch you? What did you do? I asked, forgetting he was French. He answered me in English, though. Just what you did, he said bitterly. Blew up a bridge and failed to stop the German army. Why didn't they just shoot you? He grinned. All his upper teeth had been savagely broken. Why do you think, gosse anglaise, English kid? They cannot question you if they shoot you. How come only some of you are chained? Only some of us are dangerous. He was still grinning. I suppose he had reason to be optimistic. He'd been given a second chance at life, at hope. A slim one, but better than he'd had 12 hours ago. They chain you if they think you are dangerous. The girl whose arms were tied behind her, did you see her? She wasn't dangerous. She was a collaboratrice. Collaborator. He spat into the disintegrating straw. The shattered pieces of my heart went cold. I felt as if I swallowed shards of ice. Stop, I said. Tais-toi. Shut up. He didn't hear me, or didn't take me seriously, and carried on relentlessly. Better off dead, that one. Did you see her? Even lying in the road last night, sweet-talking the guards in German. Because her arms were bound, someone would have had to help her, on the way to wherever they were taking us, feed her, help her drink. She would have had to offer favours to the guards to get them to do it. None of us would have done it. I am dangerous, too, sometimes. That morning, I was an anti-personnel mine, a butterfly bomb, unexploded and ticking. And he touched the fuse. I don't actually remember what happened. I don't remember attacking him. But the skin of my knuckles is torn where my fist connected with his broken teeth. Mitreyet says they thought I was going to try to dig his eyes out with my fingers. I do remember three people holding me back, and I remember screaming at the boy, "You wouldn't have helped her eat and drink! She'd have done it for you!" Then in panic, because I was making so much noise, they sat on me again. But as soon as they let me go, I was back on top of him. "I freed you! You would still be in chains and packed in a stinking freight wagon like a cow by now if it wasn't for me. You wouldn't have helped another prisoner eat and drink." "Keta, Keta." Mitreyet, weeping, tried to take my face between her hands to comfort me and shut me up. "Keta, arrête. Stop, stop, tu dois. You must. Wait, attends." She held a tin cup of cold coffee laced with cognac up to my mouth. Helped me. Helped me drink. That was the first time she'd KO'd me. Takes 30 minutes for the drug to work. Suppose I'm lucky they didn't hit me over the head with a bicycle to speed it up. When I woke up, they made me go with the chauffeur up to the villa. I felt like hell warmed over, stupid and faintly sick and absolutely famished. And I think I probably wouldn't have cared if the old woman who lived there had turned me over to the police. Isn't that what happens when you kill your best friend? But no, the chauffeur took me into a dark and elegant oak-paneled hall and the woman came to meet me. She's one of those beautiful, porcelain-perfect people of the last century, with snow-white hair done up in exactly Julie's chignon. I noticed that. She took my hand without saying a thing and led me upstairs into a bathroom the size of a ballroom, where there was a dead boiling bath drawn up and waiting. She sort of pushed me into the room and left me there to get on with it. I thought about putting Etienne's pocket knife to use by slitting my wrists, but it seemed rather unfair on the frail heroic woman whose house it was. And also, I want revenge, blast it. So I had a bath, which, I confess, was heavenly. Dried off in a huge fluffy towel obviously left for me, feeling sinful and a bit unreal. The old woman, I should say elderly, not old, she's a refined sort of person. She met me at the door when I came out. I was clean underneath, but my hill-walking trousers were caked with mud and my wet hair was standing on end, and I felt shabby as a street urchin. Didn't seem to matter. Once more she took me by the hand, and this time led me to a small parlour where she had a fire going and a kettle on the hob. She made me sit down on the frayed silk of her 18th century settee, while she made me a little supper, with bread and honey and coffee and tiny yellow apples and a boiled egg. The tray went on a small marble-topped side table, and she knocked the top of the egg for me with a pretty silver spoon as though I were a baby and needed feeding. Then she dipped the spoon into the egg and the yolk came up, golden like the sun popping out of a cloud bank. It made me think instantly of eating supper with the Craig Castle Irregulars the first time I went there. Then I realised that Julie and I had never been there at the same time, and now we never would. And I bent over and began to cry. The old woman, who didn't know who I was and whose life was in danger just because she had me in her house, sat down beside me on the old settee and stroked my hair with thin, wrinkled hands, and I sobbed hopelessly in her arms for nearly an hour. After a while, she got up and said, "I will make another egg for you. 3 minutes only. How the English like it. This one is cold now." She did another, and she made me eat it while she ate the cold one herself. When I left to go back to the stables, she kissed me on both cheeks and said, "We share a terrible burden, Cherie. We are alike." I'm not sure what she meant. I kissed her cheeks too and said, "Merci, madame. Merci mille fois." A thousand thanks is not really enough, but I haven't anything else to give her. Her gardens are full of roses, sprawling, old, tangled bushes. Quite a few of them autumn-flowering damasks with their last flowers still nodding and drooping in the rain. The old woman is the one the circuit is named for. Mitrayet says that before the war the woman was quite a noted horticulturist, and that the chauffeur, or groundskeeper, is in fact a skilled gardener, and she has bred and named a few of the roses herself. I hadn't noticed the roses when we arrived last night, or even walking up to the villa in daylight in a stupor, but I noticed them on my way back to the stables after my bath. The flowers are sodden and dying in the December rain, but the sturdy bushes are still alive, and will be beautiful some day in the spring, if the German army doesn't mow them down like the ones in the Ormay town square. For no good reason, they made me think of Paris, and ever since then I've had that song stuck in my head yet again. None of the rest of us was given a bath or a hot, soft, boiled egg, though cold, hard-boiled ones were passed around. I think I was sent up to the house as a diversion while they were getting rid of the lad I'd tried to murder that morning, and the other chained man. Anyway, I never saw them again. I don't know how they got their leg irons off, or where they went, or if they're safe. I hope so. I really do. Everybody else left in stages over the next 2 days. Mitrayet says it is actually safer to travel by day than at night if you are a fugitive, since daytime is when people are out and about and there isn't any curfew. I don't think I realise that, since I'm always trying to get on a plane that arrives after midnight at some distant airfield. She and I and the Rosalie owner were delivered home by the Rose Lady's chauffeur in her own car. We thought we ought to leave the old Rosalie there for a bit longer in case the Nazis come back and check on the garage again. The bridge still hasn't been fixed, and except for the German soldiers we killed, every one of the bodies is still lying there in the rain, with guards posted over them to keep anyone from trying to bury them. 15 people lying there. I haven't seen it. We couldn't drive that way anyway as the bridge was out. They'll have to clear the road when they get the bridge fixed, but I have a sick and certain feeling they will just pile everybody alongside the road to remind us not to try again. Julie. Oh, lovely Julie. Julie. I'm going to drink this stuff now and try to sleep again, but I should put down that I have a project to work on when I wake up. While Mitrayet and I were gone, a friend of Maman Thibault's who runs a laundry service dropped off a bag containing clean German-made chemises, labelled Kette Habicht. And hidden underneath them was a huge pile of paper that I have to go through. I don't know what it is, haven't had the heart to look, but it must be from Engel again. Amelie peeked and discovered that the pages are numbered, so she's put them all in order for me. But it's in English and she couldn't read it. It's still hidden in the laundry bag beneath my anonymously donated new collection of underclothes. I jolly well don't feel like reading anything Engel has sent me any more tonight, but tomorrow is Sunday and there will be croissants with the coffee, and I expect it will still be raining. It is not Engel's writing. It is Julie's. I've not finished reading yet. I've scarcely started. It's hundreds of pages long, half of it on little bits of card. Maman Thibault just keeps making me more coffee, and the girls are keeping a good watch on the road in the back lane. I can't stop. I don't know if there's any urgency or not. Engel may need the papers back, as there is an official-looking number printed at the end in red ink, and a horrible execution order on Gestapo stationery attached by the evil Nicholas Ferber. Not an order, I mean, only a recommendation. According to Engel's translation. But I think it was in the process of being carried out when we stopped the bus. I can tell when Julie's been crying. Not just because she says so, but because the writing goes all smeary and the paper crinkles. Her tears, dried on these pages, are mixed up with mine, making them wet again. I have cried so hard over this that I'm beginning to feel stupid. They did show her those blasted pictures, and she did give them code. 11 sets of encoding poems, passwords and frequencies. 11 code sets. 11 dummy code sets. One for each of our dummy wirelesses. One for each of the ONS radio we planted in the wrecked Lysander. Those pictures were a gift. She could have told them so much. She knew so much, and all she gave them was fake code. She never even told them my code name, though they must have wondered. She never told them Käthe Habicht's name, which might have given me away. She never told them anything. Names, names, names. How does she do it? Cattercup, Stratfield, Swinley, Newbury College. How does she do it? She makes it sound like she is so cut up to be giving them this information, and it's all just bump out of her head. She never told them anything. I don't think she's given them the right name of any airfield in the whole of Britain, except Maidsend and Buscot, which of course was where she was stationed. They could have easily checked. It's all so close to truth and so glib. Her aircraft identification is rather good, considering what a fuss she makes about it. It makes me think of the first day I met her, giving those directions in German, so cool and crisp, such authority. Suddenly she really was a radio operator, a German radio operator. She was so good at faking it. Oh, when I told her to be Jamie, how she just suddenly turned into Jamie. This confession of hers is rotten with error. I did my civil air guard training at Barton, not Oakway, and the fog line at so-called Oakway is electric, not gas. It wasn't a Spitfire the first time I flew to Craig Castle, of course. It was a Beaufort, and she jolly well knew that. Though I have ferried Spitfires to what she called D-side. I suppose she truly didn't want to draw attention to any real names. She calls the RAF Maidsend squadron leader Crichton, and she knows perfectly well his proper name is Leland North. Crichton is the name of the colonel in Kim. I know because Julie made me read it. Partly, I am dead sure, as a warning about how both of us were being fine-tuned for the war machine by that bloody Machiavellian intelligence officer, whose real name she also knows perfectly well. I don't at all remember the story about her grandmother's sister shooting her husband. Of course, Julie would have had to fudge a lot of our conversations to keep the flow going. None of them run exactly as I remember. Mostly it's all there, and I recognise it. And I don't think she's ever told me that story. I have no memory of it at all. It's eerie and unbearable. It's as though she's trying to tell me what she wanted me to do. But she couldn't have known what was going to happen, or even that I'd read this. She thought I was dead, so it must not have been aimed at me. But then, why tell it? What's strange about the whole thing is that, although it's riddled with nonsense, altogether it's true. Julie's told our story, mine and hers, our friendship so truthfully. It is us. We even had the same dream at the same time. How could we have had the same dream at the same time? How can something so wonderful and mysterious be true? But it is. And this, even more wonderful and mysterious, is also true. When I read it, when I read what Julie's written, she is instantly alive again, whole and undamaged. With her words in my mind while I'm reading, she's as real as I am. Gloriously daft, drop-dead charming, full of bookish nonsense and foul language, brave and generous. She's right here. Afraid and exhausted, alone. But fighting. Flying in silver moonlight in a plane that can't be landed. Stuck in the climb. Alive. 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 CDB means Chateau de Bordeaux. HDV means Hotel de Ville, Town Hall. O. HDV, A, 1872B, number 4, CDB. O means or may, perhaps A, annals, archives. B, box, what? 1872 could be year, archives 1872.
Box number 4.
I see it! Orme Town Hall. Archives 1872, box number 4, Chateau de Bordeaux.
We have them.
We have got them.
Our prison cells are only hotel bedrooms, but we are guarded like royalty. And also, there are dogs. These cellars are empty because they are not secure. There are a number of service lifts, dumbwaiters for hauling trays upstairs, in addition to the great big one for loading crates and things from the main street.
There's more. I know there's more. Engels underlined all the instructions in red. Red's her colour, Julie said. The pages are numbered and dated in red, too. Julie mentioned Engel had to number the pages. They've created it between them. Julie Beaufort Stewart and Anna Engel. And they've given it to me to use. The code's not in order. Doesn't need to be.
No wonder she was so determined to finish it. Oh, there's so much paper here.
Here it is.
There was an air raid, and everybody scrambled to the shelters as usual. For 2 hours. CDB equals Chateau de Bordeaux. As with all the prisoners' rooms, my window has been boarded shut. The Gestapo used the ground floor and 2 mezzanines for their own accommodation and offices. HDV, picked out in red, equals Hôtel de Ville. Through the cellars and out to a little stone courtyard, where there is a gate to the lower lane.
We can get in through the cellars, front and back. There is an entrance in the lower lane at the back and a loading lift through the street at the front. The cellars are not secure and they use the bedrooms as cells. During air raids, the whole place is left unguarded apart from the dogs. We will have up to 2 hours. We can pull the fuses, disable the generator and fill the dumb waiters with explosive 808 when we leave. Julie put in the great aunt story because she thought we might have to blow the place up with her inside, that there might be no other way. She wanted us to do it anyway. But we won't have to leave any of the prisoners inside. We can break into the rooms with crowbars and lockpicks and get everyone out. The official-looking numbers at the end in red ink are a city archive reference. It will be the architect's drawings for the Chateau de Bordeaux. We will have a map of the building. It's coming down. We are still a sensational team. SOE London, wireless telegraphy message, draft for encoding. Regret to report your organiser, codename Paul of Damask Circuit, and flight officer Julia Beaufort Stewart both killed in action, 1st of December 1943. Stop. Request RAF operational flight within France, route overhead Orme, this full moon Saturday 11th of December, to create diversion enabling Operation Verity. La Cadette collected the drawings. It turns out anyone can go digging in the Orme Town Hall archives. It's like Nazi contempt for the occupied country taken to extremes, as though they welcome the locals to come and ransack their own heritage so no one else need bother. You get searched when you enter the building, of course, but not on the way out. And they didn't even look at Amelie's ID. She said she was working on a project for school. Easy peasy. She was supposed to say she was verifying a boundary of the Thibault farm, but when she saw how easy it would be to get in and out, she made up a simpler story on the spot. She is so sharp. It took her 20 minutes during her school dinner break, and she left the pages for me to collect so she wouldn't get caught carrying them around. It was probably a mistake to tell her to leave them in Engels' cachette. I think of it as mine, but it's Engels. Also, I think we're supposed to avoid using cafes. I wish I'd been trained for this. It didn't matter in the end, but oh, how my stomach turned over when I walked in and found Engels sitting at the table. I started to walk past to another table, smiling my stupid plastic smile. Makes me feel like a zombie this week. But she beckoned abruptly. Salut, Keta. She patted the chair next to hers. When I sat down, she stubbed out her cigarette and lit another 2 and gave me one. Somehow it was the most heart-stopping thing I have ever done. Touching my own lips with this cigarette that had touched Anna Engel's lips a second earlier. I feel like I know her so intimately after reading Julie's confession. She must feel the same way about me, though I don't suppose I scare her as much. Et ton ami, ça va? She asked casually. How's your friend? I looked away, swallowed, couldn't maintain the plastic smile. Took a drag on the cigarette and choked. Haven't smoked for a while and never those French fags. After a minute or so, she figured out that what I wasn't saying was not a happy ending. She swore softly in French, a single violent word of disappointment, then paused and asked, Elle est morte? I nodded. Yes, she's dead.
Viens,
Engel said, scraping back her chair.
Allons, viens marcher avec moi. J'ai des choses à te dire.
If she had been about to cart me off to prison, I don't think I could have refused. Come for a walk. I've got things to tell you. No choice. I stood up again in Engel's cloud of smoke. Hadn't even ordered anything, just as well as it always panics me to have to speak French to strangers. Engel patted the thick wad of paper folded next to her ashtray, reminding me. I picked it up and shoved it in my jacket pocket along with Ketta's ID. It was mid-afternoon, streets not too busy, and Engel clicked into English almost right away, popping back into French only when we passed anybody. It's dead weird talking to her in English. She sounds like a Yank. Her accent is American and she's pretty fluent. Suppose Penn did tell me she'd been to university in Chicago. We came round the corner of the back lane and into the Place des Hirondelles, the town hall square, full of armoured vehicles and bored-looking sentries. I've got most of an hour, Engel said. My dinner break. Not here, though. I nodded and followed. She kept talking the whole time. We must have looked dead casual, a couple of chums having a walk and a smoke together. She doesn't wear a uniform. She's just an employee. She doesn't even have a rank. We walked across the cobbles in front of the town hall. She was crossing the street, right here, and she looked the wrong way. Engel blew out a fierce cloud of smoke. What a stupid place to make a mistake like that, right in the middle of La Place des Hirondelles. There is always someone watching here, the town hall on one side and the Gestapo on the other.
It was the Thibault's van, wasn't it? I said miserably. The van that nearly hit her. A French van full of French chickens, that's what she'd said in the first few pages she wrote.
I don't know. The van was gone by the time I got here. I'm sure the driver didn't want to get tangled up in an arrest. Olo May looks the other way when there's a beating in the Place des Hirondelles. Another Jew dragged out of hiding, or some idiot throwing manure at the office windows. She glanced up at the offending windows. No dead bodies hanging there this week, thank goodness.
She put up a hell of a fight, your friend, Engel said. She bit a policeman. They got me to come and chloroform her, to knock her out, you know? There were four officers holding her down when I came running across the square with the chloroform, and she was still struggling. She tried to bite me, too. When the fumes finally overwhelmed her, it was like watching a light go out.
I know. I know.
We were out of the square now. We turned to look at each other at exactly the same moment. Her eyes are amazing.
We've turned this place into a real shithole, she said. There were roses in that square when I was first sent here. Now it's nothing but mud and trucks. Think of her every single time I cross these cobbles. 3 times a day. I hate it. She looked away.
Come on. We can walk along the riverfront for about 1/2 kilometer. Have you been?
No, it's still pretty.
She lit another cigarette. It was her third in about 5 minutes. Can't imagine how she manages to afford them all, or even where she gets them. Women are no longer allowed to buy cigarettes in Orme.
I've chloroformed people before. It's something they expect of me, part of my job. I'm a chemist. I studied pharmaceuticals in America. But I've never despised myself so much as I did that day. She was so small and... She stumbled over her words and I had to bite the inside of my cheeks to keep from crying. So fierce. So beautiful. It was like breaking a hawk's wings, stopping up a cliff.